Welcome to the Latter Gay Stories Podcast, the show that features real people, real stories, and real talk. This is the intersection of sexuality and reality. Now, here's the voice of the show, Kyle Ashworth.
Thank you for joining us on another episode of Latter Gay Stories Podcast. I'm your host, Kyle Ashworth. We are really fortunate to have this podcast episode today. It's unique, it's different. It's unlike anything you've seen on the Latter Gay Stories podcast, that I promise. In fact, in the 8 seasons of the Gay Mormon Stories podcast, this is a first. Today's episode features a drag queen. And before you get too excited, we have a lot of ground to cover. We will be discussing what life is like in the drag scene, but more importantly, what led up to this experience and the opportunity that Ryan has in his world to share exactly what he's going through. This is an informative episode that I think will help you to better understand what authenticity and honesty and self-acceptance and the importance of finding your own direction and charting your own course can have on your life. We are happy and excited to introduce Ryan, also Ryanna, to the podcast.
Yes, Ryanna Woods. Don't forget the Woods.
Ryanna Woods.
My namesake is Elle Woods, of course. Whoever said orange was the new pink was seriously disturbed. So Elle Woods said, believe in yourself. So she's kind of my namesake. And Ryanna actually comes from childhood. As a kid, I was always tormented in elementary school, and they called me Ryanna, the fairy or the fag. So I just turned it around. And so that's Ryanna Woods.
Haters gonna hate, and you...
That's right.
You made hay with it.
I did, yeah, absolutely.
Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
I'm really excited to have you here. Maybe I should preface and say you aren't the first drag queen we've had on Latter Gay Stories.
Okay.
Brigham Young's son. Brigham Morris Young.
What?
In the 1800s. Was one of Mormonism's very first
drag queens. Okay, we're talking like Brigham, like... The guy who brought me across the plains.
That's the same Brigham.
Oh, my gosh. Continue.
His 35th son, Brigham Morris Young, was a drag queen. In fact, Madame Petrelli was his name.
Like, this is a real thing.
For real. Yeah. And you can...
Okay. All right. First of all, we are already spilling the tea on Brigham Young. How about that? Continue, girl.
So Brigham Young's son had an operatic falsetto and toured a wide variety of clubs and venues in drag. And in fact, I think I even have some photos. Should we judge a little bit?
Yes, I would love to see the photos. Oh my gosh, yes. Although I don't judge other people's makeup. I only judge my own. But still, let's look at this. Okay.
So on the screen, if you're watching this, we'll put the photos up on the screen.
My Lanta. This is truly like, girl, that's him right here too with the fan?
That's it, yeah.
Oh my gosh. You know what? I'm more in touch with my Mormon ancestry than I thought. My fan even looks like hers. This is real. Like,
yeah, for
this
real.
Isn't a joke playing a trick on me.
No, it's for real. That is Brigham Morris Young.
Wow, I wish they were in color so I could see that beautiful dress. The flower. I'm living for the flower. Wow. That's unbelievable.
So Madame Paterelli, she was kind of a touring queen, obviously, who were doing shows throughout the Intermountain West and quite popular. In fact, most people who experienced her show had no idea that it was really Brigham Morris Young, the 35th child of Brigham Young.
35th, that's a lot. You know what? I feel like I'm very nervous today. As always, when I'm in drag, but I feel like we could convoke her spirit a little bit. I have a little bit of an opera skill myself. Are we ready for this? Okay. Not bad, right?
That is pretty impressive.
Well, thanks. Peter, what is it? Pilip Petroni?
We'll call her whatever we want. Madame Paterelli.
Madame Paterelli, I want your ghost to, like, be my guardian angel. I'm actually wearing my grandma's apron that she made, Nana, and so she's kind of like my guardian angel, but I think Madame Paterelli would be a little more of a fierce guardian angel for me.
Right now, to be honest, I think Brigham is probably rolling in his beehived grave.
No, my theory is that all those people who didn't understand us when they were on the earth, they get to heaven and Jesus was like, girl, relax. They're fabulous. They contribute. Like, I just think that in the afterlife, there's a full understanding of the meaning behind who we are as gay people and even drag queens. But so is there any record of how Brigham responded to Madame Petroni? What is it?
Paterelli?
Pascarelli?
Paterelli.
Okay, yeah.
Not a lot, actually. I don't know that he was overly supportive. We should jump into that. If you want to read more about the story, you can go to lattergaystories.org.
Okay.
Click on stories and then scroll down to LGBTQ Mormons in History.
Oh my goodness. I can't wait to learn more about her.
And that
I'm going to have to copy her look and do her like, no, that's a big deal. Like,
it's
how did you find out about that? Like, no one has heard of that.
Just studying Mormon history, Mormon LGBTQ history. And on the podcast website, I try to dig up some of those old stories because, as we'll discuss in this interview, being LGBTQ or identifying somewhere along that spectrum isn't just a new thing. It's not the latest fad. There mm-hmm. were people who experienced sexuality different than heteronormative or heterosexuality in the olden days as well.
Wow. Yeah.
I mean, this has existed for centuries, obviously.
Yeah.
So there were people, and I tried to dig up some of those old stories of people who were gay or lesbian or trans and their experiences through the 1700s, 1800s, and even on through into early Mormonism. Because I think that's valuable to understand our history and also
to share the
stories.
You mean we didn't all choose this and we're just doing it for attention?
Surprise, we are not in 1978 Mormonism anymore.
Oh, okay. No, I chose this because being gay was so much fun and I just wanted attention and it's entirely my choice. I just want attention. That's why I'm doing this, right? That's why we're all gay.
That's exactly right.
And if we just pray, it'll go away and everything will be all right.
They say that.
Yeah.
I don't know where to start with your story other than maybe right in the very beginning.
A very good place to start
is the beginning.
Well, yes. When you read, you begin with ABC. With drag, you begin with... Oh, sorry, I tried. You know, I'll work on that one for next time. Moving on, the beginning.
But she has a better opera voice.
Well, yes. Julie Andrews, I can't pull off. Madame Pascarelli or Petroni, whatever her name is. I'm giving her a little competition.
The Ogden Distillery did do a gin based off of Madame Petrelli.
Okay.
I think it was in 2017. They have the Five Wives vodka.
Yeah.
And then this year they did the Five Husbands vodka.
I know, hilarious.
But the year before that was the Madame Petrelli gin.
Wow.
So,
well, I'm going to print off her picture because I'm really weird. I go to like antique stores and I collect pictures of people from the 1800s. I know this is psycho, but I get their picture and then I frame it in my apartment and I want their ghost to watch over me and protect me. And I pick old pictures of like fabulous women from the 1800s. So Madame
Petrelli
is going to be my new guardian angel. I'm excited. Sorry, Nana. By the way, I'm sure Nana is thrilled to see me wearing her apron today. It looks pretty good on me, though.
She and Brigham can spill tea together.
Yeah, my Nana wasn't Mormon. She wouldn't have cared. She was nice. She just watched like 4 hours of soap operas every day and did little crossword puzzles. You know,
living the dream. So you alluded a little earlier about your childhood growing up where you were teased. And maybe we should start there. At what point did you realize I'm different?
Well, it's actually a story that my mom has shared. I don't remember this moment, but she said we were in the yard. And I have a picture of this moment if you want it for later. But we were in the yard and I was feeding the dog some of my sandwich. I was about one. And she said as I was feeding the dog, he would take the bread. And then when he touched my fingers, I would go, ew! Like hands in the air. And she said at one, she realized there was something different about this kid. He's not like my other three boys and he's different. So she said she recognized that I was different from age one. And then for me, I realized I was different in preschool. My first same-sex attraction, not that it was sexual, but it was physical. You know, when you're tiny, you have a little crush. And in elementary school, there was a little boy named Jacob. And I would always just sit right next to him. And his sweater was so soft. And he had curly hair. And we would just collect snails together. And I loved him. More than just a friend, I felt a deep connection to him that I didn't feel to any girl. So I call that my first crush. Obviously, it's not an adult feeling, but that's when I realized I was a little different. And then as time went on, I was just always a girly boy. You know, I'd always be in trouble for stealing my sister's cheerleading outfits and just putting on their skirts. And there are actually pictures of me at my sister's basketball games cheering down there in front of the audience in a little cheerleading skirt, like ready to go. That's one of my favorite drag looks as cheerleader, because I always wanted to be a cheerleader. But yeah, I was always a little different. I loved girl things, which we can talk about. I don't think that those are girl things. I think they're fun things that we say only girls get to do that, which is one of my main arguments in drag, is this does not make me, these activities are not inherently female. Painting a face, colors, fashion, hair, you know, creating a character and going out and being theatrical. It's not just for women. But in our society, sorry, not sorry, the Gap and khaki jeans and a polo and like your outfit, no offense, it's just, to me, it's like, why? Why are men not allowed to be colorful? It's so strange to me. So as a kid, I was always attracted to the colorful. And I was always, as soon as I could walk, I was dancing, I was singing, I was in the school plays, I was Boo Bear in first grade, and I was the king in Sleeping Beauty in second grade, and I was the star of just all the little plays, and I loved the stage, and I loved to perform, and my mom always supported me in that. She let me do it, but it was always a source of embarrassment and shame for the men in my family, because they could clearly see that I was different. So as a kid, I just realized I was different, but obviously I didn't have a label for it until I was about 9 in a pretty traumatic way. I was exposed to what I could potentially be. So
let's talk about that.
My father, in the state I grew up in, he was the number one anti-gay activist in the history of the state. So I grew up in an environment where homosexuals were referred to as the lowest of the low people on earth. I grew up knowing that the word, can I say fag?
Say it.
Well, I'm not using it in a derogatory way. The word fag, the word queer, all of that was presented as something totally negative. And when I was about 9, strangely, I was sat down and my father explained to me the ins and outs of the evils of homosexuality. I won't go into detail. What I will say is it was way too much detail for a 9-year-old. So when I was about 9, I just had this image in my mind that homosexuals are literally out to get me. They're out to destroy our family. They're out to destroy our country. They're scary. They're evil. And our fight and our crusade is to stop the homosexuals. And the word the homosexuals was just everywhere. I mean, bumper stickers on the cars and everything. So.
And your parents were active LDS.
LDS, yes. I try to separate the church from the interpretation of the doctrines that I was given. My father ruled our home with an iron fist. There was no room for dissent. There was no room for discussion. And getting to a place of healthy acceptance with my mom took a long time, because she was also under that authoritative priesthood power, which was not, in our home, it wasn't viewed as a blessing and a force for good to protect us. It was definitely the authority of the home. So my mom, my parents got married very young, and she was a convert. And so she was also kind of under that umbrella of authority where we didn't question things. But I know all along she loved me and she accepted me and she wanted me to be happy and shine. And whenever she was, like we had a phrase, A-L-A-G, and that's acting like a girl. And so for a long time I was bitter against her, thinking, what a terrible thing to always make me self-conscious, you know, of acting like a girl. But it was her way of protecting me from the bullies at school and my family members who were at that time not okay with me being effeminate. So, I grew up in that turmoil environment. Actually, I think it was around age 9 or 10. We went to the state fair, and my my extended family always had a booth at the state fair, a political booth, for all of the causes that they believed in, many of which I agree with, but obviously the gay thing was difficult. So I was actually protesting the homosexuals at different rallies throughout my childhood. And I remember this one guy, looking back, this poor guy, he was always in front of whatever we were doing with our signs and our stickers and stuff. This guy was always there, and I remember just yelling at him. And to my father's credit, he would always kind of smile and joke with him and not be super mean to him. But me, I was mean. I was ready to just, fight that homosexual, because he wants to destroy the American family, and he has a homosexual agenda, and he just wants to ruin everything, and we have to fight the homosexuals. Like, it was a crusade. Sorry, my fabulous nail with a bow on it keeps getting caught in my fabulous hair. You know how it is.
Hashtag drag problems.
Hashtag drag problems. I hope we're doing okay. I hope they can see my earring. Obviously, I had to take this one off because it kept getting snagged in my hair, but we'll just cover that ear and make sure you can see that. I put a little polish on it. So anyway,
all this time you're out with the protesters.
Yes.
And you're carrying signs. You're advocating a message.
Yes.
But you also are hiding a truth.
Well, at that point, I hadn't connected the dots. I've always been gay. I had a crush on Travis, who lived down the street. Oh my gosh, I loved him so much. He was just, I was around 9, 10. That's when I really started having feelings. And I was just in love with Travis, and he was so, his big brown eyes, and he was so nice. So I knew that I had those feelings, but I never, for some reason, I never connected the homosexuals to me, because that was just an impossible idea. And it wasn't until later that I connected, oh my gosh, I'm one of them. And I internalized that I'm evil, and the shame really started. The shame didn't start until really after high school. I was able to dodge it and just, you know, kind of live my life and be a good Eagle Scout and be a 4.0 student and student government and leadership and everything. And because as an LDS kid, you're taught sexual thoughts are not appropriate. So as long as you just avoid sexual thoughts altogether, then you're good.
Seems to be the cure.
Right. And since I wasn't having sexual thoughts about girls, I always considered myself safe. Like, I'm good. That's not my problem. Because every lesson only talked about women and the sacredness of their bodies and all that stuff. So I just felt like, yep, they're sacred. I don't want to touch it.
Did you ever think that, this is a leading question a little bit, but did you ever think that, and it's right along these lines.
I'm all about leading questions as a leading lady. Sorry.
That maybe the church's teachings of chastity helped, and maybe you've already answered this, but maybe we elaborated on a little more, on the topic a little more. It helped to keep your sexuality at bay because you were translating the feelings that you were having as, look, I'm actually living the law of chastity because I'm not after the women. I'm not
right.
Lusting after
mm-hmm.
them. There's nothing about them that lights a fire, that turns the engine. Therefore, I must be doing exactly what I should be doing.
Yep.
And it was that ammunition that helped you move forward.
Absolutely.
And justify that, yes, my religious sacrifice is paying off.
Like, yes.
This is God working in me.
Yep.
Did you ever experience anything like that? Is that
100%. That's why I was actually a very happy teenager. It wasn't until it was time to go on the mission and the real idea of worthiness started coming into my life. And I just, from that moment on, I didn't feel worthy. So I was a happy teenager. I was an overachiever. Because I was effeminate and I knew that a lot of family members were ashamed of me and it was inappropriate for me to be in theater and dance and tap classes and, you know, all the things a gay kid loves to do, I never really worried about it because I was the shining star. And I've always been super funny and super sarcastic, and I've always hidden behind a certain level of being the clown.
Theater.
And that was my way of having an in with everybody, because if everyone's laughing around me, then they're not exposed to my heart and soul. So it wasn't, so we could just skip through high school. It was good times, all American kid, never drank, never smoked, never anything. I had a wonderful community of Mormon friends. And I wanted to actually preface everything we're going to talk about with the fact that I have lived around the world. I've lived in, Utah, Hawaii, France, Ecuador, Africa, the Caribbean, and Boston. Did I say Hawaii?
Yes.
Yeah, so I've been all over the world.
Hallelujah.
And I gravitated back to Utah. I wanted to be around Mormons because I identify with the foundational culture of who they are, and I identify with the positive elements of Mormonism. And after seeing the world and how scary and terrible it really can be, I wanted to be around Mormons again. So
it's your tribe.
It is my tribe. And I did the Ancestry DNA thing, and I looked up, I'm like, the first, you know how they keep updating it? The first time it said I was 1% Polynesian, I was like, you're welcome. But that was erased the second time they did it, but they added Norwegian. So apparently I'm Norwegian, Danish, Irish, Scottish, you know, just whatever. But their map that they show you shows you where the majority of your actual blood, your physical blood comes from, which groups of people. And the map was just this huge red spot on the United States that said Mormon pioneers. And that really moved me. So the first thing I did was create this Mormon pioneer drag.
I was just
because,
gonna say, so we
yeah,
have.
No, for real. Like, people might think I'm making fun of Mormons or I'm doing this as a mockery thing. It's not. Dressing up as a boy pioneer is boring. So I created this look, and I really do identify with the Mormon spirit. And to toot my own horn, I have been a pioneer in my own family. They now know that gay is not a death sentence, that it's not evil, that I didn't choose it, and that we can get along, and a gay person is not a threat, which is what all of us grew up. I'm the youngest of 8 children, and it's like, boom, that's the only narrative we had until I broke away from the fold, and I was the very first one out of every single, I have like over 50 nieces and nephews, and 7 brothers and sisters, and obviously this huge family. And I was the first one to question it and leave out of principle. So I do consider myself a pioneer in that sense. And I identify with the pioneer spirit of following your heart, following your beliefs, sacrificing for what you believe in, standing up for what you believe in, even if other people disagree. And just the trek across the United States, I take such inspiration from pioneer stories. I love reading about them. Because I'm a Mormon pioneer at heart, you know.
I am, and I'm glad you're not one of those Colorado City.
Right.
The
yeah.
Hillsdale.
Although I do like their long hair. I just wish they would let it down like me instead of in a braid. I just feel like those and a little makeup, maybe you know, maybe some falsies and a little glitter, maybe a little lip liner.
That could be.
I just
a drag
if ever I see them,
though.
I'm gonna be like, girls, the polygamist angle.
Yes.
You know, I probably would have been a great polygamous wife as long as the husband was hot. Yeah, I could have given birth to that.
Well, that was a long way around at 19 years old.
Well, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. So back to 19. Okay, so...
So you graduated high school.
Well, I graduated a year early so that I could get a year of school in before my mission. I really wanted to just get a jump start. So I went to BYU Hawaii and BYU Provo. Had a marvelous time at BYU Provo. Amazing school, amazing friends. Like, that's the main thing I'm grateful for with Mormonism is the incredible, wonderful people who I was able to be in a group with and feel like I'm part of something and be protected from so many bad things out there that other kids in college are doing. And I'm friends with 99% of them to this day. And even Rihanna Woods, they're like, yes, go girl. So it wasn't until I was at BYU Hawaii and I was approaching age 19 and I had had one same-sex experience that was literally like a 3-second thing. Like, it wasn't even a sexual encounter. It was just an inappropriate moment. And I realized, oh my gosh, I'm not worthy to go on a mission. Because I committed a homosexual act. And at that point, the brochure, the Strength of the Youth pamphlet said, what did it say? Homosexuality is an abomination before God. And then I think in the worthiness materials, it said something along the lines of, if you've had homosexual activity, you cannot go on a mission. So I was devastated. I thought I ruined my life because of this one little moment, just as a teenager with another teenager. So it was traumatizing to me, and I confessed to the bishop, and he said, yeah, we're going to have to get back to you on this one. I don't know if you can go on a mission. And he did get back to me, and he said, basically, we feel that you're sincerely repentant, and it wasn't that grave of a mistake. And so I was like, phew, thank goodness. And then at BYU Hawaii, I started my first conversion therapy. I went to this nice lady. There was a counselor who dealt with kids with same-sex attraction, and she gave me the rubber band to just snap whenever I had a same-sex thought. And she told me that...
Your wrist was calloused?
Well, yeah. And she told me that Paul, the apostle or the saint, I don't know, you know what I mean.
The apostle.
Paul, Bible. He had, many believe that the thorn in his side might have been homosexual feelings. So she had that analogy. It was interesting. But I felt horribly guilty. But I also felt so hopeful because she would say, don't give up. Pray. You're going to be okay. You're going to make it on your mission. And I just knew in the back of my mind that once I am a dedicated missionary for 2 years, no self-abuse, inappropriate self-touching, no deviation from the doctrine, that I will come home and God will reward me with these feelings going away. I just knew they were going to go away. So finished BYU Hawaii, came home, and I met with my leader where I lived. I'm going to try to keep it kind of vague because I don't want to out anyone who gave me rough times. But one of the high church leaders who I met with, I was basically worthy to go on a mission, and I slipped up once with what they called self-abuse, inappropriate touching of my own body. So I slipped up once, and I immediately confessed it, and I was horribly ashamed, and I was panicked on the inside because all I wanted to do was be a missionary and prove to my family that I'm worthy of the priesthood and I'm worthy of their love and approval. And mission was a great tradition in my family, you know. Other siblings had gone on fabulous missions to Japan and South Africa and all over. So I wanted to join that club, but I felt unworthy, so I confessed. And this leader said that you need to wait 3 months because you're unworthy. And I'd already turned 19. And that was the day when the darkness entered my soul. That was the day when I realized I'm evil. I'm unworthy, I'm dirty, I'm perverted, I'm secretive, because I had touched myself, and
You're everything President Kimball said in The Miracle of Forgiveness.
That's exactly what I read, and that's exactly the book that I had was referred to, and I was all of that. So the shame and the guilt had plagued me, and I actually went into the mountains. This is not a very Rihanna Woods story, but I went into the mountains behind my house and I just mutilated my own arm, scratching till I bled, begging God for forgiveness, saying, please, I know I'm unworthy. Please forgive me and please make these feelings go away. And I lied to everyone and just said that I had jumped over a wood fence and had scraped it. But the self-loathing and exactly the miracle of forgiveness type language, compounded by the language and what I had been taught in my family, was that I have this demon inside of me that makes me evil and unworthy, and I have to fight it. And I felt that I had failed because of that one slip up, and they made me wait. But I ended up working it out, and I made it on my mission, and I didn't have a slip up during the entire 2 years except once. Now, as a 19-year-old boy, at his sexual peak, science shows that a 19-year-old is at their sexual peak. For me to have not touched myself except once in 2 years as a teenage boy, to me, is indicative of the fact that I was dedicated. I was a zone leader. I loved the people I was teaching. I was just on top of everything. And I dedicated my entire heart and soul to the mission in hopes that I would come home and everything would be okay. I'd have my fairy tale ending. I'd come home straight and get married and have the hurrah. And at the end of the mission, the time came for my mom and my niece to come pick me up in France. And they came, and I had escaped the darkness for 2 years because I was so focused and so distracted and so gung-ho. I mean, I loved being a missionary. And I loved writing letters, and I loved my name tag, and I loved it. And I was so good at French, and I just immersed myself in the entire experience. But then it was like, boom, this is over. And now you have to face reality again. So they came to pick me up, and immediately darkness hit me.
Your family came to pick you up?
My mom and my niece.
And they, we kind of missed where you, and you served in?
France. Yeah. It was southern France, but that mission closed down, and I ended up in Paris. Mm-hmm. So they came to pick me up, and I was supposed to be this smiling, happy missionary. You know, here we are. It's a great reunion, but I realized I'm in deep trouble. Because these feelings are plaguing me, and now I have to face reality. I can't be in this fantasy missionary world anymore, just running away from everything, living this, you know, religious life. And depression hit me super hard. I fought with my family members. I put a hood over my head everywhere we went, and I just felt so much darkness. And coming home to the airport, it was like the darkest moment. One of the darkest moments I can remember, because I felt I was shining young, you know, missionary coming home from France, and I had my huge family there with signs and welcome home and all that, you know, marvelous works and wonders. But I just felt like if you really knew me, if you really knew what was going on inside of me right now, you would hate me and you would know how evil I am. So I went back to BYU. And I picked up on the idea that this can go away. I can pray it away. It's not my problem. Really enjoyed my time at BYU. But I don't mean to spill any tea on BYU.
That's a whole other podcast episode.
I always called it YBU. Great school. Wonderful school. But it was a little rough. So sweating like a gay Mormon in church. Sorry about that. Sweating like, yeah.
For you.
So long story short, BYU did my best, and I was dating my best friend, a girl, and it was very platonic and very innocent, and we had been best friends in high school and best friends, and during the mission, I would always kind of romanticize my letters to her just with the fantasy of, oh, she's probably the one I'm going to marry. She's gorgeous. She's blonde. We'll have our little Mormon family and our white picket fence, and I'll be just like all my brothers and sisters, and everything will be okay. But we were dating, and her father actually ended up leaving their family because he's gay. She shared that story with
a turn of events.
Yeah.
How did you process that? Did you know that he was gay as you were dating?
No, she shared that story with me and her pain about it with me. But of course it was a trigger on the inside, like, I kind of understand why. But I still at that point believed this is not me, because it's so vile. It's so evil. It's such an abomination. It's such an attack on the American family. It's such a dirty, disgusting, evil thing that, of course, I would never go there, ever, because I'm worthy of the priesthood. So that made me break up with her, at least, because I felt like I was seeing a therapist, a conversion therapist. It wasn't like what you see on those documentaries, like electroshock, but it was definitely that this is why you have these feelings and this is how they can go away. So I had great hope, like, okay, we'll work through this.
So just to back up a little, yeah. you broke up the relationship after her father came out and left.
Pretty much. Once I learned that, I just felt like it was too dishonest and too cruel to have her date someone who has the same feelings that her father had. So
she obviously reacted negatively to her father's experience.
Yeah.
And that probably triggered you.
Yeah.
And maybe in a very real sense, it opened up your eyes to the potential damage.
It completely did. I look into her big brown eyes and think, you know, I could do the same thing to you someday that your father did. So long story short, I was seeing that conversion therapist. I was at BYU and BYU approved housing, totally being a good kid. And I had a roommate who was different, very effeminate. And I just kind of got along with him, didn't really get close. But then he told me, well, to back it up, this is where the shimmer hit the fan. I broke down at BYU and I realized this is too much for me. This is never going to go away.
What was too much?
Being gay on the inside and trying to prepare for a future of marriage and children and a heterosexual future. So I started getting back to that dark place that I hit before my mission, and I was feeling awful. And one night I was driving my car, and I, without going into details, I ended up in the emergency room in a hospital in Provo. And I have the little form, and it says why I was there, blah, blah, blah. And they told me that we'd like to keep you here, but if we do, your family will have to be contacted. And then I just freaked out and said, nope, I'm fine. Like, it's no big deal. I just made this up. I'm going to leave. So I filled out the little form that said, how can I avoid suicidal thoughts? Don't think about suicide. You know, just filled it out to get to get the heck out of there, because I realized, oh my gosh, they're gonna know. And the guy who interviewed me didn't seem very sympathetic to me. So that was my first of many near suicide attempts. And
and at this point, you're still closeted to your mm-hmm. family.
100%. To everyone. And then my roommate, the effeminate fun guy, ironically named Ryan, he told me about his cousin, Stuart Masterson, who was, he was in Time magazine. He blew his brains out. I think it was on the steps of a steak center, and it was a huge deal. And my roommate, again, God's plan, I ended up with this roommate. He told me about his cousin and this terrible story. And of course, I had just dealt with what I dealt with in the emergency room, hiding it, being the shining BYU journalism student. And he said, what would you think if I told you that I'm like my cousin? And I said, what do you mean? And he said, I'm gay, like my cousin who killed himself. And I said, I wouldn't judge you. And he said, do you have anything to tell me? And I said, no. He said, it's okay. You can tell me. And he insisted, and I was like, no. And he said, just say it, Ryan. Say, I'm gay. And I did. I said, I'm gay. And it was the first time I ever officially came out to anyone. And so he invited me to meet Stuart's parents, who had been through the agony of their gay son killing himself. And we went to dinner with them, and they said that in their ward, people were telling them that because your son killed himself and he was a homosexual, that there's no hope. You know, just the worst of the worst. So they actually went to Jeffrey R. Holland, and they asked him precisely what they should believe about their son and about the entire situation. So I won't go into details of that personal moment with him, but let me just tell you that he had full compassion and full disagreement with the idea that their son was in outer darkness and that he was a lost cause. So I got to know that roommate.
And just for for clarification, at this point, the church has been very clear and open, even within the last few months, that suicide, the act of suicide, isn't a end all in
really
Mormon, that's yeah in Latter-day Saint belief, that there is room for judgment, not by man, but reserve that for God.
Good. That's how it all should be.
So the church did clarify that, which I think is helpful to the community.
Absolutely. because my so we didn't date, but we kissed. Ryan and Ryan.
Actually, the dynamic duo.
The dynamic duo.
In Helaman Halls.
It wasn't Helaman Halls. I did live there, but no, we did. And he was willing to live a clandestine?
Yes.
Clandestine, whatever. A secret life at BYU. He had no problem with that. I did. I chose to prepare to come out to my family, and I prepared for complete cutoff. Complete and total, like, on my own. So I got a job. I applied at University of Utah. I applied for scholarships. I was ready to leave at the end of that semester. And ethically, I'm not going to judge people who stay at BYU and they're secretly gay. But my analogy is, let's say you have a school for vegetarians. And I want to go to your school. And other vegetarians are paying 10% of their income to support the cheap education that you can offer me as a vegetarian at your school. And I go to your school, I'm subsidized by all these vegetarians donating, and I'm eating meat. I'm eating hamburgers on the weekend. I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with eating a hamburger, but I do think there's something inherently wrong with signing my pledge to be a loyal vegetarian, because my contribution as an educated person in your school is to continue the values of vegetarianism. And I had signed the honor code. And I wasn't willing to let Mormon tithe payers subsidize my education. I'm still in debt from the University of Utah. BYU is dirt cheap compared to, you know, with the church helps you. So I just felt that it was more morally unethical to stay there and to not live the truth that I was presenting and to not live according to their ideals.
But maybe more importantly, could you put a price tag on authenticity?
No, I had to do it. And so I prepared, I got gun-owning family, I got hardcore anti-gay conservative family. And so I was prepared, another little grace of God. Before I came out, my father passed away 6 months before I came out. And I'm not saying I'm happy he died. I'm just saying that I feel God took him right. It was a car accident. And I feel that God took him right when he needed to at his time in life. I feel like his passing was meant to be, not because I was coming out, but I didn't have to deal with that end of it, which would have been the scariest. And I think it would have prolonged my coming out a lot longer if I had to do it when my father was still alive. Lord love him. I know he watches over me, and I know he thinks I'm fabulous, and he's proud of me. I've had experiences, crazy experiences, where I know my dad's up there, and he gets it, and he doesn't care. Woo. Anyway, uh-oh, girl. No, not with this much makeup on. All right. No crying in baseball. Anyway, so back to that. So I came out of the closet. First to my niece, my Mormon niece, who was at BYU at the time. And she said, I don't care, it's fine. But then she talked to her family and she came back and said, I love you, but I don't accept this.
The great Mormon condition.
The great condition. Yes. The great Salt Lake of Mormon doctrine on homosexuality. We love you, but. And that was very painful. But then one by one, then it was time for mom. That was very rough. We were in the car and we were driving, and I told her about the night I ended up in the emergency room in Provo. And I said, Mom, I've shared this story of me wanting to kill myself and ending up in the ER. So now I have to share why that happened. And I'm gay. And she was just silent. She was driving. And she was silent, and she just sat there. And I said, it's your turn to talk, Mom. It's your turn to talk. And she said, I can't talk. I can't breathe. This is the worst thing that's ever happened to me. And she said, every gay man hates their mother. And now looking back, with our understanding of everything at that time, I see how terrifying it was to her. And our belief was that the homosexuals are going to get my son. You know, he's going to go into this dark, terrible world that's predatorial and awful. And so she was devastated. She couldn't speak. Kind of worked it out. One of my family members screamed on the phone, "Not my brother! I'm not going to let them have you! Not my brother!" And it was sincere. She was in terror. And I understand that. And that's what coming out was like for me. So I decided from day one, I am not going to be mean to them. I'm going to let them have their space. And I'm just going to try and be as Christ-like as possible and just give them their space to adjust to this. And entered another dark realm of unhealthy thinking that I'll just be the perfect gay guy and act a certain way and live a certain way and look a certain way so that I'm accepted as I'm not one of those gays.
Did that include celibacy?
No, it didn't. Just behaviorally.
Behavioral, okay.
Yeah, I didn't really share my personal life too much with them. So coming out was a total disaster. Many of my deeply Mormon family members clearly were devastated, but I got a 12-page letter from one brother-in-law about how much he loves me and how I'm always welcome in their home. And God, you know, just a wonderful letter that was a treasure to me. And the funny thing is, after I came out of the closet within my family, I know everyone's deepest, darkest secrets. Like, I know the tea on everybody in my family, girl. Whew. Let me tell you. But what I was a pioneer in the family to help us have honest conversations. And since I had come out as the ultimate evil, they weren't afraid to talk to me about their struggles as a teenager or their secret guilt or all of that. So it brought us a lot closer. And I'm not saying this is a good thing, but I started the chain reaction of people leaving the church in my family who did not believe in it. They stayed in it to be righteous. They did not believe in it. They took issue with the doctrine. So we're only about half Mormon now. And I was the one who started that. Hopefully I'm not going to be damned to heck for being that person, but I know I won't be because they're still great people and we still get along, Mormon and not Mormon. But there was a great schism and a lot of bitterness and fighting and everything. And my mom finally took many years. I had another, it's a very complex story. Coming out was the easiest part of the whole thing. It got worse and worse and worse and compounded into deeper self-loathing and deeper self-hatred. And even though I presented this smiling twink, you know, fabulous gay guy living the good life, drag didn't come till many years later, but I just presented the fun, sexy 21-year-old, you know, gay persona and took a lot of pride in my tan body and my looks and everything. And I kind of lived off of that. But inside, I still hated myself. I still internalized all of the doctrines.
You hated yourself because you were still gay.
Yes. Well, I was already out, but I secretly still hated myself and felt deep shame, primarily because of certain family members who would have nothing to do with me ever again.
I think that's very relatable. I think that experience is very relatable to the LGBT LDS community, where they understand what that feeling feels like, that I tried my best and there's this feeling that maybe God let me down. I devoted so much to him and he didn't hold up his end of the bargain. And then this idea that I would do anything to change, and I haven't, and I can't,
yeah.
And I feel Switzerland. I feel neutral. I feel stuck in this position, and there is so much shame and self-loathing and non-progress.
Yep, and I didn't overcome that shame and guilt. So what I did is I had my heart broken by my first real boyfriend in college at the University of Utah. I came out. I was at the U of U. I was just living life. No drinking, no naughtiness, just a boyfriend. And we were intimate. And he ripped my heart out and put it in a garbage disposal and threw it in the street and let cars run over it. It was horrible. And I was just crushed. And I was so burned by that experience because I gave my whole heart and soul to him. I was I was basically mentally and emotionally a 12-year-old because I had never dated and I'd never had romantic experiences until him. So that was my first time ever experiencing that. So as a naive, fresh out of the closet person who's never had intimacy, I really just gave my heart and soul to him, and he was not careful with my heart, and he broke it. So I was so burned. Side note about him, recently he killed himself about 2 months ago. I hadn't seen him in years and years, and I learned of his death. One more ex-Mormon down the drain, down into the tubes of suicide and misery. It's a real thing. It happens all the time, and I have no idea how I'm alive. So after that, I decided romance is not going to work, and being a Mormon clearly is not going to work, so I am going to globetrot and save the world and be a humanitarian and make documentaries and go around and be the adventurer and save the world, because then my family will approve of me.
Because you have your journal, you went to school for journalism.
Journalism, TV, print, and radio, yeah.
Speak fluent French.
French and Spanish,
French and Spanish. You are well-traveled, well-versed.
Right.
And I can understand the dichotomy. Mormonism doesn't work. My sexuality
romance
isn't working.
Doesn't work. So here I go.
Plan C.
Yeah, plan C. I am going to... So I globetrotted. I mean, Ecuador, Africa, Europe, all over the globe, basically for a period of about 9 years of my life, dedicated to it, just like the mission. Just like the mission. Escape into a cause, escape into saving the world, and everybody will approve of me. Because even though I can't be the perfect glowing missionary Mormon, I can still be this amazing humanitarian and do great things and help people with AIDS and give mosquito nets and, you know.
But you weren't knocking doors for a beautiful wife anymore.
No. And I was still running for myself. And that was, I had flings here and there. But never let myself go there. Stayed as celibate and as good as I could, because I still believed that I was bad. So I ended up with malaria and severe sickness and pneumonia, and I had run myself down, and I hit a low point. I had no more hope, and this was my second suicide attempt. Because after about 4 years of the humanitarian savior thing, it wasn't working. I was miserable on the inside. It was exactly the same as being that shining BYU Mormon, dead on the inside. So I planned it out, and I won't go into details, but I slashed my wrists, and I have these scars to this day. And it wasn't this way, honey. It was this way, because I knew what I was doing, and I planned it out. And there's no crying in this interview, so we're not going into the details of that horrible nightmare, but God only knows how I'm alive. What happened was such a miracle of how it happened. I have no idea how I'm alive right now. No idea, except guardian angels. So I remember waking up from that, and I was so angry that I was alive. So angry. And everybody around me, I said, I'm not supposed to be here. We're not supposed to be having this conversation. Please just let me go out in the desert and put a thing in the car and die. I don't want to be alive anymore. And you're so selfish for making me stay alive. I have nothing to contribute. I've tried my best. I've tried everything I could to be happy. It's never going to work. I can't stay alive. And they made me agree to not be in charge. They said, you're not in charge, we're in charge. And I wrote in a permanent marker on my hand, I-A-N-I-C. I am not in charge, fine. You guys do whatever you want with me.
This was to your family.
Yeah, said I'll just follow whatever you say, because clearly you're gonna watch me and not let me escape and go into the desert and do what I wanna do. And I have no idea how to handle this myself, so you guys are in charge. So resolved it, got some medications, worked on it, went a few more years trying the the globetrotting humanitarian, working, traveling, just at the Caribbean. I was everywhere. Just living the
numbing
adventure.
Yourself.
Numbing myself. And numbing myself also with alcohol. Definitely abusing alcohol heavily, heavily. That has played a great role in my greatest mistakes. My biggest mistake of my life so far. I was with some Methodist missionaries in a humanitarian realm. And they were at dinner and they said, "You've never drank?" I said, "No, I was 26. And they said, "You've never had a drink. We're getting you a margarita." And because they were Methodist missionaries and children were there, we were all hanging out, it felt so harmless. And I took that first drink, and that put me on a path of destruction that compounded all of my pain and compounded my mental illness. And so when I lived in the Caribbean, I was just man bun, goatee, rum, party time, just really lived it up.
Hakuna Matata.
Hakuna Matata. Did not care about anything. And that was another way of living. Again, running away from who I am and what I've got going on.
Well, maybe a little Hakuna Matata and Asa Diga Ibawai.
What's that?
Okay, that's a joke beyond this podcast.
Oh, okay,
from the Book of Mormon musical.
Oh, I am not a fan of that. We could talk about that. I am 100% against that musical. But anyway, what do you want me to do? Dress in drag and do the hula? Okay, so anyway, back from the Lion King, back to the Caribbean. So I was there, and I met some people who got me a job in the airline industry, and the rest is history. I was able to use my skills, my language skills, and I got that job, and it transformed my life, and I moved to Boston, Massachusetts, and had a fresh start, and once again, I had this new life, new shining face. Everyone's going to validate me and love me because now I'm a professional. I'm not this globe-trotting 20-something idiot out there, you know, living in the Caribbean. I am a professional now. And I met my ex-husband shortly thereafter. Wonderful, beautiful human being. That was the beginning of my journey of self-acceptance. Our first Christmas together when we were dating. When I was little, one of my worst life memories is I had Care Bears and Smurfs and, you know, My Little Pony type things. And I came home from first grade and my brother had burned them in the fireplace. Mm. And it was real to me. They were burning. My little friends were burning in the fireplace. I was like, but this can't be happening. And from that day on, I was only allowed to have boy toys. So they dug a fort, an army fort for me in the backyard to play army. I dug little cubby holes and put teacups in it. Racetracks, sports, forced to play sports, all this stuff, you know, to make a man out of me. To quote Donny Osmond, probably another closet case. Actually, I don't know that. I love him. But long story short, my ex, I shared a lot of these stories with him about the shame and guilt that I always felt for loving girl things. And warning to anyone out there who might want to prevent their little boy from playing with the Barbie, you're going to end up with this. You better be careful or she will become Barbie girl. Do not forbid that world from a kid. Just let them play with what they want to play with. So my ex, it was Christmas time, and we went to the Disney store, and we were hanging out. And my gift, he said, "Before I give you this gift, I want you to know one thing. I want you to love this gift. I want you to enjoy it. And I never want you to feel ashamed for loving this again." And I opened it, and it was to Anna and Elsa dolls from Frozen. And I just wept, because that's all I wanted as a kid. I just wanted a doll, you know? I just wanted to play with My Little Pony, because the boy aisle is all based on competition and sports and muscles and Spider-Man and WWF. The girl aisle fits my heart. It's smiles, it's friendship, it's family, it's magic, it's home, it's fashion. And all those toys are smiling at you. Batman's not smiling at me. Spider-Man is not smiling. It's a threat. And so as a vulnerable little kid, I wanted all of that. One of my most special memories is, I think it was my 7th birthday, my little niece gave me her My Little Pony for my birthday, and I was so excited to have that My Little Pony, but it was taken away. And so my drag is very much Barbie and Disney and My Little Pony and all that, and one of the reasons is because I had to satisfy that inner child, that inner oppressed little kid who felt ashamed for loving all of this stuff his entire life and just give, you know, a ring finger to the world and say, I don't care. I don't care what you think. I love Barbie and I love My Little Pony and I love Britney Spears and I love Disney and I love princess everything. And I just won't be ashamed. So back to my ex-husband. He started my journey of self-acceptance. Because I was still basically a naive Mormon on the inside.
A gaby.
We had to get married as soon as possible. So I proposed after 6 months. And now we'll be married.
You proposed.
I did in Disney World.
Wow.
Oh, to the castle.
Take the lead.
Oh, yeah. I was determined to join my 7 siblings in their normalcy and their marriage and their white picket fence. And then once I'm married, that will finally get me the approval of my family. Because it's stable, I'm married, I'm a good gay, you know, blah, blah, blah.
And at this point, your life is becoming far more stable. Good job, good people surrounded by everyone that...
Self-acceptance, enough to date someone and be vulnerable and have that exchange with him. But we got married so fast. We did not know each other well enough. And we definitely were incompatible, but I blame our primary troubles on the fact that I was still a self-loathing gay on the inside. Still hadn't given myself the stamp of approval. So a couple years went by. The marriage was crumbling. Boston winters were super hard for me with my mental challenges to be in that gray, snowy, dark space. And ended up in the mental hospital in 2014 for severe depression. My family's actually, they're the ones who made me do it. They said, if you don't, we're gonna put you in there because you're so depressed, you're not functioning, you're talking about suicide. And I said, fine, I'll go. And I went, but I resisted everything they told me in the hospital. I am not mentally ill. I can control this. I can change this. I don't need to be here. And so I did everything I could to just get out and get back to just being perfect. Perfect gay with my husband and our, you know, polo shirts and nice shorts. And
short shorts.
Well, no, because I was determined to be that cookie cutter gay. And one of my greatest arguments with my lovely ex-husband was he wanted to go to a drag show. And I freaked out. And I said, are you kidding me? Do you realize the harm those freaks do to our movement? People like you and me can't get accepted because of weirdos like them, because of the drag queens. We had a huge fight. He wanted to go see the Golden Girls thing. And it was a fight. So again, that self-loathing inner gay just was not letting go of me.
Every gay out there is saying the Golden Girls and drag, you're trying to take out two at the same time.
Mm. Oh, girl. But it would have been a joyful, fun experience. But I judged him for that. And I said, no way. And I questioned who he was. Because how could you accept such a deviant, gross, stupid thing to do? So
back to 9, 10, 11-year-old
100%
person who you were, the person you were raised as.
Mm-hmm. Just reverting back to it. What do they say? Old plants die deep or something? I don't know the phrase. You know what I'm talking about. Old. Anyway, not good with the analogies because we're getting to the juicy part. So let me just have a look here before we begin this part because this is going to be a little bit ugly. Ding, ding. We're good. Yeah. So, long story short, long story long. Woke up in the ICU January 1st, 2016.
As a result of the argument over the drag show?
No, that wasn't the specific reason. It was just declining, getting along, and now I've failed at the marriage. So it's just one more proof that I'm unworthy, I can't do anything right. I'm deviant. Choosing this lifestyle was the ultimate mistake because everyone predicted that I'd end up miserable. Everyone predicted that I'd be suicidal. Everyone predicted that wickedness never was happiness.
We've heard that before.
Oh, girl. That's... It's It's not in my mind anymore, but it was at that point. So one night, middle of winter, dark, horrible, East Coast, gray, windy misery, I left and I walked to a hotel and I ended myself. And again, these are not cries for help. Like, door, hotel, planned it, timing, everything. And I knew that this time it was going to work. And I took all of the pills, and they weren't like aspirin or something. I did my homework and should have died. I was ready to. And I had written my letter, and I woke up in the ICU in the Massachusetts General. And I woke up with tubes and everything and all that. And this little nurse came in and said, "Hi there, how are you? You're in the intensive care unit. I'm Debbie," or whatever her name was, "and we're going to take care of you. Are you hungry?" And again, I thought, "You're kidding me. You are kidding me. Not again. Not again." And unfortunately, well, fortunately, I had no legal control over myself because of how it happened. So I was forced to stay under their supervision and go to the mental hospital. And they sent me back in, and this time I arrived right back at the same mental hospital, and I said, "This time I'm just going to go ahead and listen. This time, if you suggest certain medications, I'll take them. This time I'll go to every group session." And I was like the leader of every group session, like asking questions and giving encouragement to everybody else, again, masking the pain by being the perfect mental hospital patient. And went to all the group sessions and went to all that, and I listened to them, and this time I really listened to what the professionals, another grace of God, Massachusetts General Mental Hospital is the number one in the nation. These people knew what they were doing, and there was one psychiatrist. The first time I went there, I hated the psychiatrist, partly because I was completely closed off to the idea that I need help. And this time, this one was just, she listened to me, and she's like, "I'll work with you. I don't accept your insurance, but we'll go ahead and figure that out. I'm taking new patients." So she worked with me, and they wouldn't release me unless I went to an LGBT outpatient program. And I was like, whatever, LGBT, what the hell is LGBT? So I went to the outpatient program where, you know, you're forced, you go during the day, and you're out of the mental hospital, but you went to this program. So I met transgender people, and this guy was like 50 wearing a dress and some heels, and a transgender guy, and a gay person, and all these people. And the first day I sat down and I said, "Just so you all know, my background teaches me that everything you're going to try to convince me of is legitimately evil, and I'm basically a Jewish person right now surrounded by Nazis. That's how it feels, because I know what you're going to try to convince me of. You're going to try to convince me gay is okay. You're going to try to convince me trans is okay. You're going to, you know," I knew what their agenda was. Oh boy, did I ever know that agenda, because I grew up fighting that agenda. But I was like, "I'll just listen." And then they did the preferred pronoun thing. This is the first time I'd ever heard of that. And I was like, "Sure, call me she. Who cares?" I had nothing to lose at this point. Zero. I had no control. So I was like, "Call me she, and my name's going to be Rihanna," which is the name they tormented me with in elementary school, "and call me she." It's like, maybe I'm transgender. So I went and bought some makeup and a little Sally Beauty Supply hair extension and put it in my baseball hat, just like I didn't care anymore. And my husband told me I need to move out, so I moved out. And I was like, I have nothing to lose. So today I'm she, and call me Rihanna, and I have makeup on, and I don't care. And gradually, in that group, this one counselor just really worked with me and helped me face my deepest, darkest demons that I'd never talked about, the deepest inner pain. And I just, in that program, finally said, I don't care what anyone thinks. Legitimately, I don't care. Who cares? If I continue to care what you guys think, I'll end up dead. I'll end up in the mental hospital again. I'll end up crazy. And you all think I'm crazy, but I'm not. I've been through too much garbage, and that's what made me crazy in the first place. So I just didn't care. I made a few little videos on Facebook with my hair, and I was like, just wear your sparkles, do what you want to do. And I thought, maybe I'm transgender. I was totally open to that idea. So I dressed up. I got this little gross shiny wig, and I went out and to a gay bar, basically looking like a Russian lady of the night. Oh, gosh. Had no idea what I was doing. Still don't, but girl, it was not pretty. It was, anyway, at the risk of triggering people, I was not pretty. So a drag show started, and this beautiful queen was up on stage with a fan blowing her hair. And she was singing this number and being all glamorous. And I was like, bingo, I am not transgender. I want to do that. And so drag was just a culmination of every single thing I've ever loved. Dance. I've tap danced. I sing. It's colors. It's makeup. It's costumes. It's theater. It's fun. It's an alter ego. And I created Rihanna Woods. Elle Woods is like my hero. I just love the whole message of that movie. And so her name was Rihanna Woods, and she was on her way from California to Boston to enter a world she didn't know and conquer it with joy, kindness, and positivity.
That's your story.
That's my story. And so it has been 3 years of my life that I've not had debilitating depression. I have depression. I have down days. I have days of self-doubt. But you know what? When things get really dark in Ryan's world, it's time to go into Rihanna's world. That's why I do my little online thing on YouTube called Rihanna's World. Because Rihanna's world is sparkles, it's fun, it's happiness, it's kindness, it's Barbie, it's Disney, it's Britney, it's Pioneer, it's everything that I want the world to be. And so when things get too dark as me, I get to step into this persona of Rihanna Woods, who is just an extension of who I am. But she is my best friend, and she saved my life. And I became my own best friend. And I will say this. To anyone who might see this, who has been diagnosed with something that feels like it's not overcomable, or someone who feels suicidal and that there is no hope, I want them to know there is hope. Listen to professionals. And if you don't click with them, find other professionals. Medication can save your life when you need it. Don't ever hesitate to use the proper medications. People who are against it are full of nonsense because it saved my life. And you can change. And the only thing that will ever make you happy is to be your own best friend. I am my own best friend. I love me. I'm like, you know what? Do you know how much I've overcome? Do you know the darkness I've been through? And the, I mean, come on. Like, death. ICU, mental hospital. I know what it's like to be on the other side of that window in a mental hospital and look out the window and think I'll never make it. I'll never be on the other side of that window. I'm sick and I'm wrong and there's no hope for me. But if I can go from that to this, and if I can go 3 years now without that deep, dark mental struggle, and I personally believe my struggle is over. I'm going to have challenges in life. But that fundamental need of loving yourself and being your own best friend and not caring what anyone thinks. I know Rihanna Woods probably appears totally psycho and totally crazy. But guess what? I don't care. I do my own thing out of protection for my very existence. And the beauty of all of this has been the joy that Rihanna Woods has brought to so many other people. They've joined me in this journey. And I wanted to show the theatrical side of drag because to me, more than anything, drag is simply theater. It's the same as the Phantom of the Opera. Told you I was good. Yeah, and people who never would come to a drag show often come to my events because there are no dirty jokes. There's no foul language. Everything's going to be G-rated, PG max, but like I want, like you didn't feel uncomfortable having your family there.
Not at all.
And when you go to Pride, would you take your kids to Pride?
I don't take my kids to Salt Lake Pride.
But other ones?
Yeah, Provo, Logan,
those
Ogden
are more
Pride.
Appropriate.
Yeah, I've absolutely taken, and they love those aspects. Just the fun, the experience, and then one of our mutual friend Vicky Walker said, "You've got to come hit the show. Bring your kids." And she's the one who invited me, and that's how I made it to Bountiful. And my kids loved it. I loved the experience.
It was so fun.
Yeah.
Our Mardi Gras background, how we recreated New Orleans with the fog and the trees. And
yeah, the kids made masks, and they had a lot of fun.
It was really great.
A great experience.
Yeah, I love the people at the Bountiful Community Church. I'm actually baptized Episcopalian now. I'm culturally and spiritually Mormon, but doctrinally I'm not. And the Episcopal Church, right after I left the Mormon Church, I got baptized in the Episcopal Church because they were gay affirmative, and I just couldn't let go of my Christian faith. Jesus, take the wheel. No, for real, like I am a Christian woman, Christian drag queen, Christian man, and I'm not willing to let go of that. So I love the Bountiful Community Church. They're absolutely amazing. I'm a different kind of drag queen. I'm the craziest, but hopefully that's a good kind of crazy.
No, I never planned on having a long list of queens coming on the show, but I thought this was such an interesting story of adversity and pain, and the idea that you grew up in a homophobic family, closeted, and were able to keep that bottled up to the point where at some point it had to explode, and when it did, it wasn't beautiful. And it led to something that has become productive and exciting.
Yeah.
And in a very real sense, it is contributing to the happiness of other people. I saw the way my children reacted to this.
Yeah.
I saw 150 people standing on their feet, cheering and excited.
Confetti flying over the audience.
Confetti everywhere.
Oh, yeah. Sparkle, silly string. We had a good time.
And that was because you were authentic and honest.
Yeah.
And for me, that was a story.
Yeah.
What would your advice be to a closeted young man or woman who fears coming out?
You know, I feel like coming out, maybe in the Mormon world, it's still pretty tricky, but you'll be celebrated. Don't you worry. You're going to have so many people just jump on the chance to support you and be there for you and just be all excited about it in today's world. And if it's not your family, it will be a group at school. It will be people online. But my advice would just be to listen to every episode of Latter-day Stories. Seriously, it's an amazing starting point for anyone who doesn't understand themselves or the Mormon Church or homosexuality in general. And just listen to, start with season, it's 8 seasons, right? Start with season 1. And just go for a hike and listen to every single episode. And write down how you feel before you listen to the first episode. And then write down how you feel after you listen to the very latest episode. Because that's what I was missing when I came out. I had no examples whatsoever of gay people except my friend at BYU. He was nice, but he was a flake. And then my ex-boyfriend, and then I just avoided gay people. I took a lot of pride in the fact that I had no gay friends because I did not support the gay community. They're disgusting. They're all skanks, and they're all shallow, and they're superficial, and they like drag queens and all this stuff. And I still feel that way about many elements of our community. Unfortunately, one of the primary gathering places for gay people is bars, and I think that needs to change. But my advice would be start with this podcast because I've been listening to it and your story is fascinating. And that would be a good starting point. And also, did you say someone who's considering coming out?
Yeah.
Well, I know I'm not supposed to look at the camera, but let me tell you, anyone who's watching this, if you're closeted and you feel like you can't come out, you can and you will. But there's a right way and a wrong way to do it. And let me tell you what the wrong way is. Those little apps that all us millennials are on all day long, tapping on Grindr and that nonsense, no, 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 no. Bars, no. Clubs, no. That is not where you want to find your community. Reach out to people like Kyle, like myself, like the Bountiful Community Church, like Mama Dragons, like so many, Affirmation, there's so many places where you can find a safe haven to come out without the pitfalls of feeling like you're a loser, so you have to just find acceptance where you can get it. Because I'll tell you what, anybody's accepted in a nightclub where people are doing drugs and drinking. anybody is accepted around drunk people who are not in their right state of mind to make rational assessments of who you are as a person. Don't let hugs from drunk people in a bar be your refuge. Find the resources that I just mentioned. We are out there. And you and I didn't have that benefit. This is all pretty new. These organizations are very new. So sorry, I know I'm not supposed to look at the camera, but I want them to remember that, because my ex-boyfriend who killed himself, he chose that path. He chose to escape into that dark gay underground of Grindr and promiscuity and losing yourself in temporary pleasure and acceptance, which is never long-term, and it never leads people to happiness. And I just really feel like young people, I see them, they'll come out, young meaning, 2 years younger than me.
So 19.
Yeah, okay. Well, all right, I'll admit it, I'm 25. Anyway, just kidding, I'm not 26. So, long story short, they come out, they go to Pride. It's time to wear a thong. It's time to wave a flag. It's time to take shots, girl. It's time to watch RuPaul's Drag Race. It's time to get on Grindr. And it's time to join that shallow, bright side of our world that is actually the dark side of our world. And those pitfalls destroy lives. Drugs and drug use within the gay community is rampant. I've seen it way more than I would like to admit. I mean, people are escaping. And I think it's because a lot of them are in that place I was as I went along this journey. And you hide the inner self-hatred by being fabulous and being... Now, P.S., it might appear as though Rihanna Woods is just another step in that journey. But she's not. Because I don't care what anyone thinks. And back then, I lived for what others thought. Going to be the perfect humanitarian. I'm going to be the perfect missionary. I'm going to be the perfect married gay guy with the white picket fence in Boston, New England. And then people will approve of me. Where now the inner dialogue is, what will make me happy and what will make me proud of myself as I go to sleep tonight? And as long as my inner voice and people I truly love and trust who know me are aware that I'm not hurting anybody and I'm happy, that's all that matters. So that's the difference. This is not another attempt at running from that inner darkness. The darkness may come back, but I have tools and methods now of dealing with it. I just feel like it's in the past. It's been 3 years. That's the longest I've gone in my entire life without severe depression. So I'm just like, Rihanna Woods, she's where it's at.
What does the future look like for Rihanna Woods?
Oh my gosh, I can't talk about a lot of things that I have in the works right now. Huge, wonderful, exciting things that I'm working on. I got my first booking for stand-up comedy in Louisiana. My friend, I was in D.C., and she booked me to do a stand-up comedy in Louisiana. So stand-up's something on the horizon. I'm going to Vegas on June 10th to meet with some people who have some ideas for what Rihanna Woods can do. And I'm no longer thinking in terms of performing in a bar. I've had my fun. I've kind of worked on my makeup. I've gained the confidence that I need. And now, well, that's why I contacted you. I waited a super long time.
I've been trying to get this interview scheduled for a very long
time. Well, since Mardi Gras. Yeah, it's been a while.
February.
I wasn't willing to do it because I just didn't have the desire to share Rihanna Woods with anybody else. I have, obviously, and I do have fans that I don't even know, but I'm close to them because they message me, and it's amazing to have this community of people who love Rihanna Woods, but I wasn't willing to share the man behind the makeup like I did today. But I am willing to do it, and I wouldn't have done it unless it was Rihanna. She gives me that extra boost of confidence. I mean, how can she not? Look at her.
Yeah, and I think the other half of that that experience is the experience. Is the this is a manifestation of all the years of repression
and all of it,
all that you hid and buried and kept yourself from. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a respectable and honest experience. Yeah. And it was worth sharing. It was worth understanding.
Thank you.
It might be my most unique interview.
Wow. What a compliment.
You are the most
colorful. Don't tell anybody else that. We don't want to spill that tea.
And not to say that all the others were boring.
No, they're not. But Ryan was crazy.
Like, this is different.
What's going on there?
Yeah, this is different.
Yeah.
And it's been enjoyable. And I appreciate you taking the time to share your story with us.
Well, it's my pleasure and my honor. And I just hope that, well, I know the type of people who are watching this. And like you say in your podcast, there's the Mormons who are going to find this way too liberal and way too out there and way too against the church. And then there are the LGBTQ people who are going to say that I'm way too quick to make excuses for the Mormons and say that I love them and look over the problematic elements. I'm not. But in conclusion, what I believe about Mormons is they don't have to accept me. And they do not have to change their doctrines. And they do not have to adjust their core beliefs because this is America and they have the right to believe that. That being said, I have the right to say wholeheartedly disagree and I wish they would change. But I believe in their freedom. I don't attack them because they disagree with gay people. And I totally have confidence that in a very, very short amount of time, there's going to be a place for gay people in the Mormon church, and then they're going to get so much fabulosity, they won't even know what to do with it. Can you picture the Sunday school lesson I would give? The display? Oh,
can you imagine what word choir would sound like?
Thank you. Or the young women's activity when they hire me to come do everybody's makeovers? Hire me. That would be
youth
free.
Youth conference. They might even bring back road shows.
Oh my gosh. Whatever happened to that? If any
Mormons
out there want to
cast me. They got rid of all the gays. That's what happened to the road show.
No, for real.
That's
yeah.
Probably,
I look like one of those girls in the 80s and 70s doing the road show thing. Yeah. No, they're missing out on so much love. I don't know how much time we have. Are we done?
I have no idea. I have enjoyed it.
I have one more thing that I'd like to share. I have no idea why gay people exist. It is kind of a mystery. We don't reproduce. There's just so many elements of it that are totally confusing, and it's like, I don't get it. But I recommend a book called Coming Out Spiritually, which was written by a guy who really influenced my philosophy as to why gay people exist. They say we're about 10% of the population, and that seems about right. Everyone has a gay cousin, uncle, brother, sister, whatever. So if you think about it, why do we exist on this planet? And I believe God intended for us to exist to be that extra buffer for the mess that naturally happens in the heterosexual world, meaning death, illness, orphans, all of those things, the elderly. Because if you are a heterosexual person with a wife and children, that takes all your time. But why wouldn't God set apart another group of people to be that person to be able, I have a family member who's passing right now. And I have the time, the energy, and the compassion to spend with her because I'm gay and I don't have seven children like the rest of my brothers and sisters. So I believe that that is our sacred role within our families. Have you ever noticed as the gay one in your family, you've been the one people come to a lot?
They respectfully call me the black sheep for that reason.
Yeah, they share everything with you. I know secrets that I would never share about so many people in my family, but I'm honored that I'm the one they shared it with. So that's our role as gay people. And I cannot tell you how many female friends I have who love me, and I'm so close to them because I provide that unique experience of having male companionship and, you know, a testosterone-filled being, as well as a feminine companion in one that balances them and makes them feel safe and loved and protected and gives perspective that, sorry, no one else can give. As a gay person, you do have both within you. You understand the masculine and you understand the feminine, and that's a gift. But so many of us don't awaken that gift, and we don't understand the sacred role that we play in people's lives. I'm so proud of the gunkle that I am. I can't tell you how many magic memories I've created for my family members as the gay uncle with makeovers and dance and fun and travel and games and video and all fun things that we do. And also as Rihanna Woods. They're exposed to something so different and so new and so exciting, and it brings them so much joy. So we as gay people have a sacred role within our families, and within society. And I personally believe that so far, overall, we've missed the mark. And as time goes forward, with all of the internal bickering and fighting within the LGBT community, that we're also missing the mark. We are spiritual beacons of hope who are different from everybody else. In some Native American cultures, they had that separate being who was not a boy, not a girl. They were different. But instead of saying, you're bad because you're different, they'd say, this one is a wise one. This one has something to teach us. Because I'm as man as they get in so many ways. I'm not a transgender woman. I'm just a drag queen. And I'm very happy living my life as a male. But I also have access to feminine attributes and perspectives that the average straight guy that I know doesn't have. And so my sisters and my family members, especially female, are able to open up to me and have that brotherly love with a female aspect. And it's sacred. And I'm proud of that. I'm no longer ashamed of what makes me different. I'm totally proud that I'm able to be that special person in their lives. And they've told me that. So...
fascinating.
Yeah.
Thank you again for sharing your story.
Of course. Of course.
We are, at least I, for me, it's an enlightening experience, and it really has been a good opportunity to get to know another flavor and another experience of someone who is here and experiencing this again.
Well, it's an honor. Please ask your listeners or anyone to follow me on Instagram or add me on Facebook or find me on YouTube. They can email me directly. I'd be more than happy to answer any questions. admin@ryannawoods.com. So if they go to admin, like the word administration abbreviated, @ryannawoods.com, they can send me their questions or concerns or insults. Like, I'm open to any dialogue. I'm all about free speech. So let me know what you have to say. And truly, if you have something terrible to say to me or you would like to insult me, I would rather hear it to learn from it. And maybe there's some truth in what you said and I could learn something. And if it's totally hateful and awful, I'll just go ahead and say thank you for your email. God bless you. Jesus, take the wheel, you know. But all dialogue, I'm open to it because I'm not an insecure person anymore. So just let's talk.
That's honest.
Know? Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you.
Ugh, my nail just keeps getting caught in this hair. All right. I just want to know, I just hope that this video, I hope I look pretty. And if I don't, do you have a little filter you could throw on there, a little something?
It's not Snapchat, so I don't know what we can do.
Well.
But look at your competition. I think you're doing just
fine. Well, oh, you're very sweet. Maybe next time we'll just put a little Vaseline on the lens, get the Doris Day thing going on.
A little soft focus, glossy and blur.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you, Kyle. This has been a tremendous experience. I'm honored to have been a part of this, and I hope that people understand drag queens a little better.
And your story.
Yeah, yeah.
Ryanna Woods.
Thank you.
Thank you. As we mentioned, if you do have a question about something we talked about on the podcast and you are watching one of our video versions through YouTube or on our Facebook channel, we invite you to make a comment below and we can easily answer and talk about those questions and open up a forum of discussion regarding this topic. The Latter Gay Stories podcast is your opportunity to understand the intersection of sexuality and reality, where it meets at LDS Avenue and LGBTQ Street. But most importantly, episodes just like this help you to continue writing your Latter Gay story.
This episode is a production of Latter Gay Stories. We are always looking for new friends. Give us a like on Facebook and follow us on Instagram at Latter Gay Stories. The podcast is made possible because of generous donors like you. Make a donation now by texting the word STORIES to 77948. Your donation gives us the ability to build bigger bridges by producing more Latter Gay Stories. Want more? Find this episode and others online at LatterGayStories.org.